Hey, Daily Digest listeners. If you're like me, then you really enjoy Free Talk Live and the message of liberty. Yet you also may not have a lot of time to listen to an entire episode of Free Talk Live. So you listen to the Digest instead. If you enjoy the Digest, please donate $5 to $10 per month via Patreon, or send some Bitcoin or Ether instead. See the show description for details on how to do so.
Here are the highlights from the latest episode of Free Talk Live. Visit freetalklive.com for the full episode.
Back in November, just a couple of months ago, there were four states that wound up the voters passed cannabis legalization referendums or ballot initiatives in those states.
Hear, hear.
Thus bringing to eight the number of states plus the District of Criminals, so a total of nine jurisdictions within the United States where possession of cannabis is at least depenalized as long as it's under certain amounts. Now, the U.S. is definitely not the first country where, at least in part of the country, if not the entire country, it's perfectly okay to have what they deem personal amounts of certain substances. Story mentions Portugal and the Netherlands, where actually back in 2001, Portugal removed all criminal penalties for up to like a 10-day supply of substances, which if you had a 10-day supply of a substance in the United States, you would probably wind up being hit with an intent to distribute charge. The story does mention, and this is something that we talked about last night, that Uruguay and Canada last year voted to legalize and regulate cannabis, but we know that the regulatory schemes are not in place yet in Canada. But for anti-drug war advocates who are concerned about the social cost of the war on drugs, the quest for justice has been leading entire nations towards legalization, an action that is commonly followed by regulation. And while legalization helps to protect users, regulations often help to insulate certain growers and sellers with access to the market, keeping competitors at bay.
I've had this conversation with, I've spent most of my life, let's say, on the right side of the spectrum. And the right side has probably traditionally been more anti-drug and more pro-law enforcement and things like that. But I've found it really useful to start talking about the costs of what this is. And it's not just the cost of enforcement. We throw billions and billions of dollars into a drug war. But there is that cost that's hard to enumerate of what you've done with millions of people's lives. You know, suddenly you've got to check a different box when you go to apply for a job.
Well, I think war is actually like the right word for it, because what we've done is we've taken one group of people, the police, and another group of people, the people that use things like marijuana and other things on the black market, and we've literally put them at war. Like, you have people throwing flash bang grenades into
in
homes
your room, right?
That otherwise
into
would be getting crypt. Along peacefully,
sure.
But just because of these laws. I remember, was it last summer, I took my daughter to the fireworks display on the Cape, and there was this law enforcement agency that were giving like a demo on like the canine unit, and so they had like somebody dressed up wearing like the padded clothing, and they would sick the dog on it. And they were promoting the idea that the guy, and then they were showing the kids watching, like, how the dog can sniff out drugs and stuff like that. And I'm thinking, this is crazy that they're even, like, promoting this. And second of all, they held up one of the dog's vests that they said cost about $40,000 that they got from a grant from the federal government.
And I'm guessing when they were showing off how well the dogs can detect drugs, they didn't show that the dogs will wind up signaling like 80% of the time when there's not a drug there either.
Yeah. And I mean, just the fact that the dogs are being trained to bite nonviolent people, like, to me, that's sick.
Now, the question is, how do you educate somebody? And of course, everybody is different. But what really brought me around was watching, I believe it was on the History Channel, but I don't remember, but it was, I believe, titled The Untold History of Drugs in America. And
actually, that sounds familiar. I think I've seen
that. Was, you know, the first time I ever heard that in the late 1800s, early 1900s, one could purchase cannabis, cocaine, and heroin from the Sears and Roebuck catalog.
You bet.
I was never taught that in schools. I was always just taught drugs are bad, okay? Even though they didn't exactly say it that way, but, you know,
you used to be able to go buy a Coca-Cola that was made with real coca.
Yeah. I remember this little rumor when I was a kid that people would, and my friends would say, if you ate the poppy seed bagels at Dunkin' Donuts, you were doing drugs.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, it will give you, if you eat a large enough amount of poppy seeds, it will give a false positive on a drug test.
Really?
And well, I know a guy when I worked hospital security.
So who ate 16 pounds of poppy seeds?
I worked hospital security for a while, about a decade ago.
This has been a big bagel.
And this, one of the guys brought in, his wife had made poppy seed bread. And he was like, who wants poppy seed bread? And nobody really ate any of it, but he ate like half of the loaf.
You got to. You can't take it back home to your wife and none of it's eaten because then she'll be like, what's wrong?
Well, the problem is, we had random drug tests that day.
Oh, nice.
And he came up positive for opium. And he was like, I swear I didn't. And everybody, do you know anything? And it's
I kind of want to eat a poppy bagel now and then take a drug test just to test the theory.
Well, you can do the test yourself. And that's a good point, Daryl, because there are lots of things that can give a false positive reading.
While legalization helps to protect users, regulations often help to insulate certain growers and sellers with access to the market, keeping competitors at bay. By imposing taxes and rules, governments set up barriers to entry, giving growers and sellers without access to capital even more incentive to stay in the black market. And I'm going to pause here to mention something that they do not. In several of the states, they've even set up barriers that not only prohibit people without access to capital, but some people with access to capital that have blemishes on their record from entering the market.
Interesting.
Yes. So there,
blemishes?
If you have ever been convicted of a felony for distribution of cannabis, you are prohibited of the states that I've looked at with either recreational or medical, you are prohibited from working in that field because of said blemish.
I have a proposition. Okay, so in the industry, if they legalize marijuana, why not give the jobs first to the people that are currently incarcerated for what was once the crime?
Hey,
right? They're the professionals.
Because that would make sense. Now,
what happens to, like, in Colorado and stuff? So, like, what happened to all the people that were in prison for possession? Do they still have to finish out their sentences?
I don't know. I do know that in Vermont, they wound up the governor that just left office a couple days ago. He did, although, you know, technically, in order to get a pardon, someone has to file a pardon application. And he set up anybody that files an application by, I think it was Christmas Day or Boxing Day. And then he gave himself a week to go through all of those applications and said that he was going to pardon every application that came across his desk.
What governor was this?
Outgoing Governor Peter Shumlin.
Well, he deserves a round of applause.
Yeah, yes. It was a really, really good move. And to me, that should just be the default in every state that goes and legalizes recreational.
Here's a question for you. Since Maine already allows medical cannabis to be sold, why not just allow those facilities to sell to anyone, whether they have a card or not?
Well, Daryl, that would involve a little bit of common sense, and that's not often heard of in government circles.
Right, and it's been, 3 years since cannabis legalization took place in Colorado, and they are just now deciding that the medical dispensaries will be allowed to sell to recreational users.
As far as the way they put the fly in the ointment, so to speak, is here in Arizona, at least, in the we have a referendum initiative here, And what they did the first two times that the voters passed medical cannabis, the legislature turned around and repealed it, essentially. And what we finally had to do here in this state was have a constitutional amendment which prohibited the legislature from overturning the will of the people. And I think that's what you're going to see in a lot of these places.
I suspect you're right. The problem I have with the referendum process is it really is mob rule. This is pure democracy. And while to a lot of people that sounds really good, if a referendum process is too simple, then you simply do have mob rule. You no longer have any
right and
representative government, which
Ian
is
and Mark,
allegedly what we're supposed to have here.
Ian and Mark have talked a lot about the way this process was used down in Florida, to where somebody collected the signatures back in the 90s to, let's build a really fast, you know, super fast choo-choo train.
Nice.
And everybody, or not everybody, but, you know, like a majority voted for it. And then
Walt
2 years
Disney built
later,
it.
And
oh,
then
it's a
two
different
years
one.
Later, there were voters that said, let's get rid of the super fast choo-choo train. And it got enough votes to pass. So
was it a monorail?
It wasn't a monorail. Right. It was like some, you know, maglev high speed something. Like, let's connect Orlando to Fort Lauderdale with a super fast choo-choo. The LA City Council apparently is considering an ordinance that would limit playgrounds to children and guardians and ban single parents. Chris,
yeah.
You've got the story?
I do have it pulled up here. This comes from the Times editorial board. And the headline is, LA proposed ban on single adults near playgrounds is fear-based policy policy making at its worst. In an attempt to make Los Angeles parks seem super safe, City Councilman Mitch O'Farrell has proposed barring adults unaccompanied by children from entering playgrounds. It's an effort, he said, to keep city parks, quote, free of creepy activity, unquote. Who would want to ban creepy activity or creepy people from playgrounds? But what O'Farrell is
really
proposing,
creepy.
I know, goes far beyond targeting worrisome activities that in most cases are already outlawed. It would bar any adult from sitting on a bench, exercising, or otherwise enjoying public space near playgrounds unless he or she brought a child along. Is this really necessary?
Yeah. The article that I had read before on this, though, did mention that part of the law was inspired by people using drugs on playgrounds.
Yeah.
And, like, leaving needles and stuff like that behind. Then there's also the creepy people that I'm sure it was kind of, like, directed at, too.
Right, but there are creepy people that hang out at gyms as well because they know that, oh, there's going to be pretty girls
there's
in spandex
hotties.
Here.
No, yeah. Seriously. That's why I don't go to a gym.
Now, I will, since you mentioned it, there is, here in Keene, a gym only for women.
No, I do Shanti's Insanity Workout.
Is that Curves or
pure
something?
Cardio.
No, it's Downtown Fitness for Women. Like, it's not
it's
part
right
of a
there
chain.
In the name. Okay.
But, you know, like, it's just a fitness center for women.
I actually play on playgrounds, and I'm 26. So,
exactly.
Like, is
some
this
people
now
just
a
have,
crime?
Does this mean I can't go on I can't ride the slide anymore?
No, so, you know, like, I'm
only 52.
I think I've got a legitimate question here, because there are parks, for instance, that are, you know, just listed as City Park.
Right.
Where they have swings and a slide. Does that then make the entirety of the city park a playground? Or is it only the area inside the railroad tie with the tree bark surrounding
the
equipment? So
I got,
like,
one. What if there's a playground on a beach? Are you not allowed to go to the beach now unless you have kids?
You can only go to the...
Isn't it Santa Monica's got a playground right on the beach, right?
You can't go to the sandy area of the beach. Now, what does Councilman O'Farrell have to say? Well, LA Weekly has the article, and it says, Councilman O'Farrell got some bad press this week, and this is actually from about a week ago, so last week, after he proposed that adults who aren't parents or guardians be banned from publicly owned playgrounds. The LA Times editorial, or rather the LA Times editorialized that the prohibition would, quote, assume that every adult without a child is a pedophile. In a letter to constituents, O'Farrell clarified his motion, emphasizing, this is not a ban on adults without children from using parks. However, he did not back down from the proposal to ban adults without children from the parks. Chris, you're old enough to where, you know, I don't think you have grandchildren
Chris, older.
Yet.
Oh, jeez.
But,
man.
You know, you're close.
I'm grandfatherly age. Is that what you're saying, Daryl?
My grandmother God. Was a grandma when she was 42. So, okay. You know, I'm 5 years away from that. So the point is, let's just say, or maybe you've got nephews and nieces and you don't arrive with the rest of the party. And you then try to leave with, you know, your grandkid or your nephew
right.
or your niece.
I think his whole lot is just
and then you've got the, you know, 17-year-old kid that's working the thing. And he's like, but you don't have the same stamp. And then, you know, the parent hollers over, that's okay. That's my brother. That's my dad.
The most common accident that there is involving automobiles is the rear end. And I know that in a lot of states they did away with red light cameras because there was such an increase in rear end accidents, which led to higher fatalities.
Now, I just pulled up some statistics here.
Oh, good.
And data shows that 57% of New Mexico pedestrians killed in 2014, and there were 74 for the entire year,
okay,
which equals 3.53 per 100,000, which it is the highest across the country. Florida is number two with 2.96 pedestrians killed per 100,000. But alcohol was a factor in 57% of those, with pedestrian impairment being the number one factor.
That's
of
interesting.
Pedestrian deaths.
So, Sarah, I mean, this is kind of where I'm going. And this goes back to the conversation about correlation and causation. If you have 57% of the accidents involved a pedestrian that was drinking at the time, shouldn't that be what you might look at as opposed to just the camera?
But let's look at the year when we only had 47 pedestrians killed in New Mexico when we had red light cameras.
You know what, though? Even without the cameras, I'm pretty sure if those people looked both ways before they crossed the road, they'd still be here.
Let's just say ban Heather, because Heather, evidently out of the three of us in this room, is the one who loves to go play on the swing set.
I do. I like to go on the swings. I'm not really a slide person because I don't really fit anymore. But
whoops. And that's an embarrassing 911 call, folks. I'm halfway down a slide and I'm stuck.
The proposal was inspired by residents who have complained of drug deals and disturbing behavior taking place at playgrounds. Well, okay, and as we mentioned earlier, if it's really about, you know, the drugs at the playground, then, you know, either focus on that, not that I think that there should be a war on drugs, or here's a better idea. How about remove all of the criminal penalties and then people won't wind up going to places in private to do their drug deals?
I think, too, that, like, I don't think that it's as big of an issue as they make it out to be as far as, like, people creeping around playgrounds. Like, there might be creepy people, but the odds of, like, your kid getting picked off are not, like, as high as they're making it out to seem. But I would encourage parents, anyway, to have talks with your kids.
Sure.
Right.
Like, you know, about stranger danger. I've had the talk with my daughter. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? That if anybody she doesn't know, don't talk to them. Like, run away.
Well,
like,
when I was a kid, the
make
claim...
Make sure your child knows your phone number.
Right.
The claim when I was a kid was, if you're at the shopping mall and I lose sight of you, then somebody's going to come kidnap you and kill you, behead you, and throw you in the lake.
Right.
Because there was the movie about John Walsh's kid that came out in the early 80s when I was really young. So, you know, like that was the scare tactic for me of if you lose sight of mom or dad in the shopping mall, then you're going to wind up getting killed and beheaded.
Yeah, I hate to break down laws into two separate categories, but there's those laws that create more power for the government that are oftentimes passed using fear. Let me scare you so yeah. I can control you.
Before Uber came to town in 2014, Austin police data showed that the city averaged 525 drunk driving arrests per month. When these numbers were revisited a year after ride-sharing came to Austin, drunk driving arrests had dropped by 5%. The trend continued the following year when the number of drunk driving arrests dropped by an additional 12%.
Nice.
Bringing the average arrest to 438 per month. In May of 2016, the same month that Uber and Lyft made the decision to leave, the monthly rate of drunk driving incidents was down to an average of 358. However, within the first few months of Uber and Lyft's absence, the number of DUI arrests increased by 7.5% from the previous year. In the month of July alone, the city had 476 drunk driving arrests. Though many Austin residents, including the Tatum family, who they mentioned earlier in the article, predicted these new regulations would result in increased drunk driving arrests, being correct in their assertions gives them no pleasure. And let's see if they have, they do not have anything updated from July. Did you know that President Barack Obama, the, you know, the Nobel Peace Prize winner guy,
2009 Nobel Peace Prize winner,
has presided over more weapon sales in the United States than any other president since World War II? Am I reading that headline correctly?
I think you are. This story comes to us from Motherboard, and it begins. President Barack Obama, who won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2009, will leave office in a few weeks with the dubious honor of having sold more weapons than any other American president since World War II. And experts say President-elect Donald Trump will most likely sell even more. Most of the arms deals, totaling over $200 billion in the period from 2008 to 2015.
And I believe the numbers that I saw recently were about $40 billion of those were last year alone?
Could be. Maybe that'll be touched on in the article. I don't remember that detail. But most of the arms were sold between 2008 and 2015 have ended up in the Middle East, according to a Congressional Research Service report published in December. I've spent most of my life as a neocon. I've always loved my country. I've usually hated my government. But we are such an exporter of death, and this is not what I think our founders had in mind when they laid out a plan for us to try to follow, that the United States should be the one who decides what types of government exist around the world, and we should form them and manipulate them through sweet arms deals. We are an exporter of death, and it just troubles me that so many people see that as, if you question that, you're just not patriotic.
The funny thing is, most of the people that will say, you know, like, oh, if you don't like America, then leave, will also simultaneously say, I don't know why all of these people are leaving Syria. They should stay and try to change it.
Yeah, fix it.
So what is it? Do you want people that don't like their government to leave, or do you want them to stay and try to fix it?
I'm trying to stay warm here in Arizona. It's cold out here.
Hold on.
How cold is it there in Arizona?
Well, tonight is supposed to get down below freezing where I live at.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Relatively speaking, that's chilly.
Yeah. Yeah, I think yeah, we got up into the low 40s yesterday, which was kind of like a heat wave.
I stepped outside a few minutes ago. It was a balmy 22, which for this time of year is kind of one of those nights where you go, it's not so bad.
Yeah, and I'm actually going to wind up being in Phoenix in a couple of weeks, so hopefully I don't bring the cold, frigid temperatures with me.
The congressional report, quote, conventional arms transfers to developing nations 2008 to 2015, unquote, notes that Egypt was the biggest recipient of arms deliveries last year, worth $5.3 billion.
Egypt has always been, like, pretty hefty welfare recipient from the U.S.
Yeah, they've been a good customer, and that they were a strong ally because they border Israel, you know, back during the days of Sadat and brokering the peace accords and things like that. The U.S. has really, really, really wanted to control the Middle East and the Middle Eastern oil for decades, and this goes back to the petrodollar and us going off of the gold standard. This goes back to Nixon, and it even predates that. So it's unsurprising that we do that. It's also unsurprising that Obama would not have or that he did continue basically the policies that had preceded him, and that is continue to fund and fuel these proxy wars. Because,
I mean,
hey,
Egypt, it was the Muslim Brotherhood, wasn't it?
Yeah. And over here, it's United Technologies and, and Boeing and all the companies that, that do very, very well with war.
My favorite bumper sticker that you can actually go to libertystickers.com and get says, Barack Obama has fired more cruise missiles than all other Nobel Peace Prize winners combined.
There you go. Russia remains the United States' closest competitor with around 20% share in the market. Its most important client is India, which was the second largest importer behind Saudi Arabia at $34 billion over a period of 7 years, as well as Latin American countries such as Venezuela. I hope they're getting payment in advance from Venezuela.
They are probably getting payment in U.S. dollars from Venezuela.
You just heard highlights from the latest episode of Free Talk Live. You can download full episodes, subscribe to our podcast, listen live, and more, all for free at freetalklive.com.